Thanks, mate. Sorry, guys, I've got... what race am I doing tomorrow? Brenda Coxider. And I've just had to give my licence to my director. That's what he came over to ask for.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore and I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we're here just once again briefly to introduce the latest in our Adam Blythe interviews series, aren't we, Lionel?
We are indeed.
This week, it's a former rider, Tim Harris, who may be familiar to some of you and not to others. Tim was a rider in the 80s and 90s with various teams in the UK and abroad, and he rode for a time in Portugal as well. He was British National Road Race Champion. He rode for Festina before Festina became infamous in 1998. In retirement, he lives in Belgium, and he has helped a lot of young riders. I mean, you name a talented or successful British rider of the last decade or so, and chances are he has stayed in Tim's house in Belgium and been shown the ropes of Belgian racing there.
And Adam Blythe was one of those riders, and as Adam will explain in the chat he has with Tim, you know, he went to Belgium with a certain reputation already kind of pinned to his back, and Tim Harris and his partner Jocelyn Ryan have really kind of set riders on a path towards the professional ranks and kind of given them the skills they need to survive, first of all, in Belgian amateur racing, embracing not just the racing, but also the lifestyle that is required to thrive.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know Tim Harris a bit because he works at the Tour de France as well. He drives VIPs and guests for Skoda at the Tour de France. And he's one of these guys who he's always got a story, always got a bit of gossip. Has his fingers in lots of different pies, so he's a very interesting guy, and hope you enjoy this chat that you had recently with Adam Blythe.
You are listening to a special episode of the Cycling Podcast, Adam Blythe Interviews.
Before we cross over to Adam Blythe in conversation with Tim Harris, we must say a big thank you to our title sponsor, Rafa. They title sponsor the Cycling Podcast across all the different podcasts that we do, and their new core collection has just launched, with including their core cargo bib shorts. The bibs, which are Rafa's entry level shorts, have been updated to offer everything you need for every day on the bike. They allow you to carry more whatever the style of riding, featuring the same hugely popular pockets on the legs and the back, first introduced in Rafa's Explore collection. Whether it's a spare gel on a mountain effort or a camera on a weekend adventure, carry more of the things that turn rides into memories. The core bib shorts have been given full mark reviews by Road CC, Cyclist, Velo News, Road Cycling and more. For more information, go to rafa.cc.
All right, hello everyone. Here today with probably one of my best mates, who I've known not that long, but 12 years, what I mean, it is a long time. Tim Harris, a lot of you will know him and have heard of him, but a lot of you might not have, as he lives in Belgium, an old professional, don't really put his face in the media much. So, yeah, Tim, you used to be national champion, 1989. That's the year I was born.
That's true.
Massive vedetta. Oh, by the way, Tim's got his own language, and it's called Dorganese, and it's basically a mix of Portuguese, English, Norfolk, and Belgium. So if you hear fodder me or anything like that, it's a bit like, oh, me, or vedetta means great, or you star, or something like that. So if you hear me and Tim say vedetta or fodder me or anything like that, it's not swearing, it just means either bad or good or really good. So Tim Harris, national champion, 1989, and Tim, you were in a lot. I don't even know really all the teams you're in, but yeah, talk through your career when you started really, and then building up to national champ.
Okay, I turned pro in September 84 for a Dutch team called Allo Snacks. The season after, I was in RVP Vidatel, also Dutch team. And for the next two seasons, ANC in Great Britain. And a couple, for the next years after that, Rally Banana. And I won national championships for Rally Banana. Then signed for Festina in Spain. And after that, won a couple of stages in the Tour of the Algarve in Portugal. And so I signed for Portuguese teams for a few seasons. And then for the last four seasons, I made my own pro-continental team called FS Maestro. And I packed in 96. It was my last year.
What do I mean, 96? I thought it was... Yeah, are you sure? Yeah, oof, I thought it was a lot bloody sooner than that chap. It lasted longer than I thought. Pardon me. So Festina, that must have been... ANC and Festina must have been the highlight of your career. Back then it was, you know, a lot... They were the two big standout names that I know. Festina for different reasons. ANC just because they were full of good cyclists, really. So how did you get about getting into... You know, back then, like nowadays, you have to come to Belgium or France and you get noticed. But obviously back then, everything was a lot different. I mean, it's the same, but it's massively different to nowadays. You know, you haven't got all these British cycling and all that kind of stuff. So how did you go about turning professional?
Well, in some ways, it was exactly the same way as you did. You came to Belgium. I went to Holland when I was... I went to Italy first. And when I was a junior, and I won a race in Italy. But they'd had some new rule in that you couldn't be a foreign rider. So the other option was to go to Holland. So I went to Holland, where I raced for an amateur team there called Willeboord Wilvereld. And really, there's modern ways and there's old-fashioned ways, but still, like as you see now, a lot of riders just come here. If you do okay, you can make it to be a pro, and if you don't, you don't. But in reality, not much has changed. You know, it's a bicycle race, it's a bicycle team. You either do something or you don't.
Yeah, it's just what Tim always used to say to me. You always need to do something rather than nothing. If you do nothing, you're not going to be anyone, are you? So that's basically how I know Tim. That's how he was a professional. And then I ended up living with you when I was, I think, 17 now. I think, yeah, when I was 17, I moved to Belgium and came to live with Tim. It was through Phil Griffiths that I moved in with you. It was a funny old story. I left the academy not really wanting to be there and sort of not really knowing what I was going to do, but had to do something. So I applied for Rainer funding, which Tim now works for, and he recruits a lot of riders, and a lot of riders have always gone to live with Tim in Belgium to try and make it professional. But I actually got refused Rainer. Do you remember? I got refused Rainer funding. I had to go to CTT.
No, RTTC.
RTTT, sorry. So I had to go to them, and I got funding through them, and it was 250 quid a month. And Tim, I used to live with him, charged me 250 quid a month for rent. So I was left with nothing. But yeah, when I moved in with Tim, it's quite a funny story, actually. I'll let him tell you about it. But he was... Still is good friends with Rod Ellingworth, and Rod used to run the academy. So when I left, Tim asked Rod what he thought of me, and I'll let Tim tell you the story of how it came around that he heard my name and got introduced to me, really.
Yeah, it was quite a funny story, really. I didn't know Adam at all, but I knew Rod Ellingworth, who was a really good friend of mine, and also Phil Griffiths, who's also a really good friend of mine. And I remember I was in Italy at the World Cyclocross Championships, and I get a phone call out of the blue from Phil. And Phil says, right, you've got to take this this young lad. He's just been booted off the academy. I said, well, who is it? And he said, this is Adam Blythe. But all I'd heard really was bad things about Adam. So he hadn't really impressed Rod too much in his behaviour, shall we say. But Phil sort of press ganged me into taking him, so I didn't really have much choice because Phil had helped me a lot when I was racing, and I'd raced with him in ANC. So I thought, okay. So Adam arrived. I picked him up at the airport. I says, right, I've heard you're a complete twat. You got 1 month to sort yourself out, otherwise I'm bringing you back here. And that's how it started.
That was it, really. And then we got on all right since then, haven't we? We've done quite well, really. But yeah, funny how it happened, really. I just came to you, and then me and Tim got on like a house on fire. We didn't really we had quite a lot in common, being such different age groups, really. It was quite a lot of the simpleness of bike riding and how we both fell in love with it when you were young and when I was young. So then when I came to live with you, it was sort of like I was a little beaker. Sorry, Tim's name's character name's Beaker.
Yeah, I liked Adam from the start because he just wanted to race. And okay, we had a lot of riders come through. You never know how good or bad somebody will be. And I remember taking his first race, it was Brussels Lot Bike, I think, with the amateurs. And I remember him finishing, and he finished. And he just said he couldn't believe how hard it was. And but then he just kept wanting to race. Every time there was a race, he wanted to race because he wanted to make some money as well, because he needed the money because I'd taken it all off him. Which is part of the business plan for him. And I was, and he sort of got me back riding a bike again. So I used to train with him quite a lot. And we used to just, sprint for the signs. That's what we did. Sprint, 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 sprint all day long.
Yeah. It's funny, really. Like, looking back now, when you look at what we did in training together, it was never planned out. It was never, we'll do this today, we'll do that today. We never sat down and looked at it. It was sort of a, right, you've got a race in 4 or 5 days, let's just work around that. And that's what we did. It wasn't like any structure to it, but it was just constant. It was just constant riding your bike. And it was always, every time we went out, we'd have a point system for signs. So like little town signs would be 1 point, province sign would be 10 points, country signs, very rare, but they'd be like, yeah, below a million points. We'll get back onto that, you beating me. So we'd always go out and we'd always bat around these signs and we'd always race each other and that kind of stuff. And Tim was 50 and it was always, I'm not sounding horrible here, chap, but the main thing is I'd always beat Tim, but he'd always race me. So he'd always race me and always try and knock me down the ridge. So he'd always try and either knock me off to win or he'd just try and beat me some way or another. But it was taught me quite a lot, really. Always, you know, it was the simpleness of bike riding. It wasn't going out and pressing set and doing a load of efforts. It was just going out and the simpleness of going hard and battering around and going to a load of races and trying to win. It wasn't looking at your watts and trying to increase your watts.
I think if you probably looked at the training, it was, if you did it back to front, in the fact if we'd have had power meters and if we'd have had all the proper training plan, if we'd have looked back at it, it was probably pretty perfect training, because you had the long rides, you had the interval training, which was the sprinting for the signs. So although on paper it wasn't really structured, in reality it would have been, looking back at it, because we did all the things that you needed to do to be a good bike rider, really.
So I lived with Tim for 3 years, hiding Nutella pots under your bed. When I was a first year, when I went to Belgium, I never could drink the milk. I hated the milk out there and all that kind of stuff. So I'd like go to Tim's house in the morning and I'd just have chocolate milk on my cocoa pops and all that kind of stuff. And Tim used to, you didn't really say anything then until you found 10 tubs of Nutella under my bed. So yeah, I spent 3 years living with Tim, and then I eventually moved out, but just down the road from Tim. But I think what I got from Tim is that he taught me in those short amount of years that the simpleness of bike riding. I always remember you telling me it's a business, you have to remember this is a business. And I'd go and do these races. I remember after a couple of them I got a few seconds, got a few thirds, and I was always getting up there in a couple of commesses. And Tim, you know, he'd come back from a few and Tim would be like, bloody hell, you must be making quite a bit of money now. And I was like, well, it's only €80 for a second, Tim, and this and that. And he was like, you're not getting paid. And then I didn't know about it. And then Tim told me all about it. You know, if you're going to those finals, you need to offer yourself out to help someone for money or something like that. And that's what Tim taught me, is that it's a business. And even in those races, there's money to be made. Not if you win, but there's a guy called Guy Smet and a few others. You used to go to these commesses and they'd want to pay you to let them win almost, or help them win. So that sort of struck a chord with me. And if it's happening this lower down the line, there's deals to be made when you get up the line. And it's not like I've ever made massive deals in bigger bike races, but it still happens. And Tim brought that down to me in quite a young age, that everything is sort of, it's not for the love of the sport, but there's always money to be made in it. And it's a short period of time that you've got to make your money. And for me, that short period was being an amateur and trying to make enough money to pay rent, really. And Tim sort of brought that home for me. But back in your day, that must have happened a lot.
I mean that's throughout history. You don't have to if you look back throughout history of bike racing, there's always been prize money. And it was before it used to be really a sport for the poor people in Europe, to be honest. It's now it's become more of a middle class sport, but before it really was more for the poor people. It was a way to get out of poverty in Europe, and so in every race was money to be won, and people won races, or they might have sort of not sold it, but helped somebody else through the race and got a bit of a back pocket or some money in the back pocket. And that just went on. That's part of the sport and part of the interest in the sport, because also in Belgium you used to have a lot of bookmakers. Not so many now, but still in West Flanders, I think. But so it was a lot of the way I look at cycling. If the only way you can compare it with the Anglo-Saxon world, England, Ireland, maybe Australia, I'm not so sure, but is it's the same like horse racing. In England, there's horse racing every day, and there's betting on horse racing every day, and it's day in, day out. And basically, that's Flanders. But there's a race more or less every day, and throughout history, people have betted on it. And you have to look at it a little bit like that.
True, yeah. A week later from that story, I went and earned $2,000 in four Kermesses. So yeah, it's a lesson quickly learned. But no, I think moving back onto Tim and what he does now with his partner Jocelyn, there you help a lot of kids these days, and a lot of riders want to come and be professional. They want to, you know, come and live the bike rider's dream. But we both know that's not as easy as it always looks. I think on paper these days, there's a lot of guys coming through British cycling, and they just go into the process of going into Team Sky when they're good, and a lot of riders try to make it on their own and get off their own back, but a lot of, I'd say, 85% fail and 15% make. So yeah, Tim said, yeah, not even, but even less. But do you notice within that first month of them living with you what it takes or not takes?
Normally, in a month, you can see if somebody's really got it or not, because especially we're in March and April, they arrive. Most of them have been swanning around Spain and training camps and stuff, and then they come to Belgium and it's complete reality. Anybody that's watched the Belgium Classics, most of you will have seen how the pros race, but the amateur racing is exactly the same, if not even more crazy. So in every single category in Belgium, you've got the equivalent of the Tour of Flanders or Harrowbeek, but for the amateurs. And when you've just arrived from the UK and you're put into a race like that, it's a complete shock. And you'll know pretty quickly. For example, after Adam left, Dan McClay came to stay at ours, and the Dwars Door of Vlaanderen, they had an amateur race then, under 23. I think it was 280 starters. He'd been here for 2 weeks at ours, a proper race, yeah, and he won it. So then you automatically know that he's not a donkey.
Yeah, and with that, you know, when I was training with you, you ate modern chat. Tim's very old school. He doesn't train without an helmet. I shouldn't say this, you'd get a gang of stick, but Tim doesn't train without an helmet when he's at home on his own, but only because it's old school and that's what he's always known. You do train with an helmet every now and again, though, chap, now. If he's working for Skoda on the tour, which he does, he has to wear an helmet, so he does. But yeah, Tim's super old school in the ways that he's never believed in modernness, really. You don't like power meters, you don't like, you wear heart rate monitor, you wear, which I guess is fairly modern, really. Okay. So I guess Tim doesn't like all that nonsense around not being a bike racer. I think I agree with him, you know, you can't go into a race these days, and so many people are obsessed with looking at power meters and, oh, blimey, my threshold's this, my threshold's that, but you can't do a race based on your threshold. You don't go into Tour of Flanders or a Kermesse going, oh, I better not go that hard because this is my threshold. And like I said, Tim's very old school in a way, but can you see riders that come across and do all that, as we say, modern chat?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. I mean, everybody lives and races in the era that they're racing and living in. So when I was in Rally Banana, for example, we had dieticians, we used to go to Withershaw Hospital to be tested, and we had training schedules and everything. And obviously, you race to the best of your abilities and use every single thing that's available in your time, which is now if you're racing. But what I think that what has been forgotten a little bit in all the training schedules and the power meet is actually the racecraft, I'd put it. That's in the fact of how to do racing, where to put yourself in the world. I mean, the thing is, like, everybody talks about aerodynamics. If you're sat on somebody's wheel, that's pretty aerodynamic, because the bloke in front of you is taking all the wind, so you have to learn that sort of thing. If you're not going to the front, you don't need to be that aerodynamic. And then yesterday was the best example I've ever seen. I was watching Noker a race, and the Italian guy attacks, obviously not used to riding in Belgium, looking at his heart monitor, went down Death Ridge and crashed in full view of the entire world. So you obviously everything's got a place, but you have to learn to race, and tactics or another. I mean, like last week, probably in Paris, Paris-Nice was one of the best examples. One of the most impressive pieces of riding I've seen in the last few years was actually Luke Rowe guiding Bernal in the echelons when it split, because for a little Colombian to be in the front split in an echelon stage when you had six jumbos, Luke and Bernal was one of the best bits of riding I've ever seen. So the fact that Luke could do that in such an impressive fashion is because he knows how to ride a bike, he knows what he's doing, knows where to put yourself. You can have the most amount of power in that entire race, but if you don't know where to put yourself in the bunch, when that goes into echelons, you'll be in the last echelon and you can be the best rider in the world. You won't jump from echelon to echelon. And that's what I mean by you have to know how to have that racecraft in a modern race, an old-fashioned race, any race. You have to know where to be, and that's where the wind's coming from, where the hill's going to be. You have to study the route. Yeah,
it's true fact. Like we've always said, I think I wouldn't be in a pro if every chuffer knew what to do, because like my engine's tiny. Probably neither would you, probably. You know, I think me and Tim were quite similar, as though we always used to be able to put ourselves in that right position.
I always remember when Adam turned pro for Lotto, Mark Sargent, the owner of Lotto, put it in the newspaper because Adam had been in a break all day in Japan, and when it was about minus 10, it said in the headlines in the paper, Adam Blythe, he has a 50cc motor but knows how to use it to the advantage of somebody with a 500cc motor.
It's true. In fact, I call myself a Vespa now, chap. I can keep up in traffic, but I can't go faster than that car at the front of the traffic. So I think that's, you know, it's... It says a lot about cycling these days. You can have all the power in the world, which most people have got now, because they're all into FTP and all that kind of... Do you know what FTP stands for, chap?
No, not a clue.
FTP?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, me neither. No, I don't know what it is. Do you know what TSS is?
No.
Training stress score.
Okay.
So he's acting like he knows what that is, but he's no idea. So yeah, I think that's... Like, going back to that racecraft, I wouldn't have been a pro if everyone had racecraft. So I think, you know, all these people as strong as the sun that come to Belgium and can blast out a load of numbers but can't actually race, they're sort of the people that we need in racing, because without them, if they were as clever as us, I wouldn't be pro, because everyone would be clever as we are and they'd be at a position like we are with the numbers they have. So we need these people in cycling, so keep doing it, guys. The guys with the big numbers, keep doing it.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
The voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, interrupting Adam Blythe and Tim Harris there to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by DNA Fit, who provide genetically guided fitness and nutrition insights for training solutions and long-term health benefits. DNA Fit has helped 50,000 people unlock their health potential through genetically personalized fitness and nutrition insights. And Richard, you are the 50,001st DNA Fit customer, and last week we heard from your consultant Tom. What's the latest?
Yeah, I did have a consultation with Tom Lancashire, the Olympic middle distance runner, and another of DNA Fit's consultants is Craig Pickering, who was a very good sprinter and is a well-qualified sports scientist now. Tom and I spent quite a lot of time discussing the most surprising aspect of my results, which was my power endurance response. Let's hear from Tom again.
You actually have, ironically, again, to add sort of fuel to the fire, one of the biggest power responses I've seen. We don't see many, certainly over 80. I think I can remember seeing maybe an 85 or maybe a 90, whereas on the endurance, the most common thing is probably more on the endurance side, maybe around 60-40 endurance to power.
Right.
I guess is the average. So you're very much at the far end of the spread.
So have I missed my calling? Have I missed my calling here?
Maybe. I don't know. You could have been Chris Hoy, but never mind.
So that was Tom Lancashire just talking about my power endurance response, which for me, who's focused all my life on endurance sports, was very surprising. And as I said there, made me wonder whether I'd missed my calling. We went into a lot more detail about nutrition, injury risk, and so on. You get a lot of information from your DNA test about whether your genes make you better suited to endurance or power-based activities, but also about your VO2 response, your recovery speed, your injury risk, also your optimal diet, and whether you might have any intolerances or be particularly sensitive to, for example, gluten, alcohol, or caffeine. The disclaimer is that your genetic makeup is only one part of the picture. It's not a method of prediction or of identifying talent, but very interesting to discuss my results with Tom Langsham. We'll hear a little bit more, perhaps on the nutrition side, next week.
I'm very keen to know whether you've got any intolerances to alcohol or caffeine, Richard. It could alter the grand tours for us.
Well, the very interesting thing about that, but I'll tell you about that next week, Lionel.
Okay, well, we'll wait for that. DNA Fit has robust science behind it. Every gene they look at has at least 3 peer-reviewed studies on human subjects. And in 2016, they released the world's first genetic exercise intervention-based study, showing that you can discover what kind of exercise works best for you. DNA Fit are offering 20% off to all of our listeners. So start your personalized journey today by heading to dnafit.com/TCP. That's TCP for the Cycling Podcast. To access the discount code and discover more, that's dnafit.com/TCP.
This episode is also sponsored by the British Heart Foundation, who organise the annual London to Brighton bike ride. And they would like to offer £5 off your entry for this year's event. Or if you can't ride yourself, you can sponsor the Cycling Podcast team instead.
Where actually are you, Richard? It sounds like you're maybe... Are you getting some training in for the event?
Yeah, that's not the London to Brighton bike ride you can hear in the background. It's Scheldeprijs in Belgium, just outside Antwerp. I'm at the Sprinter's Race, which Adam Blythe is actually riding.
There we go.
He's got number 1 on his back, number 11, so team leader for Lotto
Soudal. Who's going to be our team leader for the London to Brighton, though, now that you know who's in the lineup?
Well, we've put together quite a team, haven't we? Quite a squad. Who's the leader? Who's the sprinter? Who's the climber?
Careful. I think you're going to have to drag me over Ditchling Beacon. Maybe that's the job for everyone else. Everyone else at my service, and then I'll finish it off with a sprint along the front in Brighton. Well, no, I don't want to be there first, do I? Because I'll have to buy the first round at the finish. Anyway, London to Brighton bike ride is really close to my heart because I first rode it when I was 14 in 1990, and I remember just what a great sort of fun day it was. There was a sense of camaraderie, so I think it's the perfect event for a bit of Cycling Podcast team bonding, isn't it? And it's for a great cause. The British Heart Foundation's research into heart and circulatory diseases is essential because they're responsible still for 1 in 4 deaths in the UK. The ride itself is 54 miles long, 17 miles of them are on completely closed roads. And as Richard said, you can get £5 off the entry fee by going to bhf.org.uk/L2B2019 and entering the code Brighton5. That's bhf.org.uk/L2B2019 and the code is Brighton5. Alternatively, sponsor us. We've raised nearly £1,000 already. We'd like to raise as much as we possibly can. Go to justgiving.com/the-cycling-podcast.
So I guess, chap, when you were growing up, it was very different era to when I was growing up. And when I was growing up, it was still 2008, 2009, 2010. And even back then, it's very different to what it was now. You know, I think even the use of having a painkiller in a race and all that stuff, that was fairly, for me, it still is now, having a painkiller in a race, it's not really a bad thing, but it used to be very much normal. You know, even doctors nowadays, if you ask for a painkiller, they'll be like, are you in pain? I'll be like, no, it's going to be for my pain in the race. But I guess back in your day, it's quite a sensitive subject, this. Was there more going on when you were first year, like when you were growing up?
I straddled complete 2 eras because when I turned pro, that was an era when like people used amphetamines and anabolic steroids, which everybody knows because a lot of people got caught on it. But in about 1990, suddenly everything started to really change. I remember riding the Worlds in Benidorm, and I was okay. I think I punched it in the finale, but I was a pretty reasonable ride. I was, and then suddenly the year later, I couldn't keep up with anybody, and but nobody really knew. Suddenly, Italians who you'd been beating or easily as good as were suddenly like unbelievable top riders. So obviously, we know now what it all was. It was the sort of the changing of the era from amphetamines and things to EPO and actual blood doping. And yeah, that was completely 100% different era. And
but did you notice the difference? Like when you were saying now, if someone, or back in it, like when I was growing up, it wasn't, I was just brought into it. So I wasn't, it was that level is what the level was. And then, you know, you get the odd guy that goes super good that's never gone well. But it was the level where I've been quite constant, apart from a few guys, which, you know, you hear of, and then they go off the scene a couple of years later, a couple of Russians or something. But for me, the level's not really been, the level in cycling has just gone up and up and up through modernness and people getting faster due to equipment and all that kind of stuff. But did you really like go through one season to the next and then go, what's that? Am I not training hard enough? Or did you know straight away it's down to help?
No, we just completely, we didn't know what happened, because suddenly from the one season to the next, we couldn't hardly keep up. And the thing was, it was all in the site. If anybody looks at a cycling magazine, I've got still got a load of my in the warehouse of cycling magazines from 1990s onwards. It's full of articles about training with heartbeat monitors, and the Italians had discovered all these fancy new training systems. And to be honest, we were in it, and I was in Festina, and before they were brought into disrepute, let's say, but there was nothing going on. There was no organised doping or anything. And then suddenly, everybody was just super fast. And if you weren't, that was it. So it was just suddenly a crazy thing. And you either really did it or you didn't. And that was that.
And just like flicking a switch, I guess. It's just literally like some guys just all of a sudden got stupidly good.
Yeah, because it's more or less proven that if you took EPO, it's 20% better automatically. So I rode once, I was in the break in Harrowbeek. I was, I don't know, 10th or 11th, natural. If I'd have been 20% better, I'd have won it, shall we say. Okay, so if you are, it's things like that. So yeah, I can look around now, and there's a lot of people you know, won a lot of races, you know. But that's just how it was. But we didn't, at the time, we didn't know. It's only in hearsay and afterwards, when all the stories have come out, when you've packed in, that you really knew how widespread it was.
Yeah, I can imagine it, but I can't imagine it really. Is it that mental?
Best rider, I think the best rider I've ever, best English rider I think I've ever seen, apart from like Malcolm Elliott and Joe McCoughlin, was a lad called Ben Luckwell from Bristol. Yeah. Ben Luckwell was unbelievably good riders. When he was he went to the Olympic Games in Seoul, I think it was, and he was still working full time on a building site. He did he'd won stages in a milk race and could beat most of the pros in England. But his career coincided really with that EPO era, and he had no. If he'd have been racing now, he could win the Tour Flanders 100%. But he couldn't even finish a race early when he came to Europe because of it. So his career, and people like him, Andrew Roach, another unbelievable good rider. Guys who he's, I think, I don't know if he's got the record around the Isle of Man, he might still have it. But they were just unbelievable riders who were unfortunate to have their careers ruined by what was going on.
Sad, isn't it? You never really, well, it's never really you think about it, but you hear about these blokes who were good riders and that, but it's just like you say, the era and the time just didn't allow them, unless they did.
I was lucky.
They did drug stuff. You were lucky.
I was lucky because of my best results were before it all came in. So at least I had the chance to have 5 years when it was normal racing. Yeah. Because that era of amphetamines and stuff, whether that actually works or doesn't work, no, it's not really proven. It's more psychological. So whether somebody's better than you or not because they took amphetamine, you don't really know. But in EPR, it was 100% different. So, but at least I had the chance for 5 years to prove myself until it was all over.
So when I was living at Tim's, I spent 3 years living with Tim, two in my own apartment, and then I moved to Monaco after that, and looking back on it, it wasn't the best choice I ever made, and we all know about that. But Tim always used to tell me it's a short career, and even this was like two, three, years into my professional sort of thing. It's a short career. You need to make the most of it. And he always used to say to me, you need to do something. You can't just ride around being average at something. And I think that's it's still the same these days. You need to be good at something. You need to be good at riding on the front. You need to be good at climbing. You need to be good at sprinting. You need to do something these days. And I think so many people these days, it's why it's so hard to stay in the job. You can't, a lot of people can be average 80% of the year, but being good for 20% is so difficult. And I think that's why a lot of people these days have had to retire, especially this year, being the sport and what's happened to it is super difficult.
Yeah, last year really was a difficult year because obviously everybody knows quite a few teams stopped, and a lot of friends of ours, you know, friends we've all grown up with.
But it's not this, it's not just this year though, is it? It's every year, but it's only because our friends we've really seen it since.
That's true. That's 100% true.
Since time begun, it's been like that. But people are shocked because it's your mates. Yeah.
Yeah, you've always had to prove yourself. Yeah. So, like Adam says, you either come up with the goods or you get another job, and that's the long and the short of cycling, really.
And it's sad. Well, we've already discussed that, and that's what Tim always used to tell me. You know, once it's over, it's over. And I was looking at stopping last year. Glad I didn't, because I'd have had to come and work for Tim Harris Chairs. But when you stopped, was it difficult? Did you look at your bike and hate it, or did you know what you were going to do? Because earlier we were sat having lunch, and Tim was telling me, you know, he went through stages of when he didn't have a contract and he drove to Italy and things like that. So tell him that story.
So one year, I didn't think I was going to get a contract. I didn't know what to do, and this was really before all that coffee craze had hit Great Britain, and I'd been living in Spain and I'd seen these mobile coffee espresso bars. And I thought, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. So I drove to Milan, and there's about six espresso factories in Italy. So I just knocked on the door of all of them to see if I could buy an espresso machine and start up this great idea I was going to do. And but then I got another contract, so it didn't happen. but looking how big coffee's become in the meantime, maybe I should have done, really.
Should have done it, yeah. You'd have been a millionaire by now. But no, Tim now owns, you're in a chair business now, don't you? So if anyone's in the market for chairs that's listening, timharrischairs.com. Is that what it is?
I haven't got a website.
Oh, you haven't got a website. That's how old school he is. Look, don't wear an helmet, he hasn't got a website for his company. But did you find it difficult when you stopped? Did you go through quite a while sort of wondering what you're going to do, or did you know straight away?
I remember having, I had an interview once for a magazine, and I said the hardest day of your bike career is the day you stop. Because every single day since I've been 14, you'd woken up with a goal. And you said it was to do your bike, the next race, the next training camp, the next whatever you were going to do. And so I was just, obviously, that's what you do when you're a cyclist like you do. You just, every waking moment is cycling. And then from the next one day to the next, suddenly you've got this massive, empty, huge space. And it's not even about the fact of getting a job or not getting a job. It's the fact that you need to find something that's going to motivate yourself to get out of bed. Because every professional cyclist is a highly motivated person. So it's not like you're just going to a job when you're a cyclist. But from the minute you stop, you have to find something that you want to do that will sort of fulfill your needs in wanting to do something.
I can't imagine stopping and trying to find something that you love that much as much as you do cycling.
I hated it when I finished. I couldn't look at a bike. I didn't want anything to do with cycling whatsoever, because I sort of felt like you'd had your career sort of taken away from you because of all that EPO going on. So when I finished, I didn't want anything to do with it. But the guy that got me back into it was the famous Tom Barris of Spats. Spatsware. Is it Spats? Yeah, the great Spats. Because obviously I raced with his dad, Sid. And Sid phoned me and said, oh, I've got a son, he wants to try it in Belgium. So Tom came and lived in the next village to me. And he says, oh, come on, you have to come out on a bike ride. So I went out with Tom. And Tom was a fantastic bloke. So that's really sort of, I got back into it and got interested again and started going to the races with Tom and his team, and slowly got to sort of like it again for what it was, rather than just the nightmare it had sort of become.
But after all like you finding your love again for cycling through Tom and his dad and him getting back on the bike, you really went back into cycling because then you started working on the tour. And I think, so Tim works on the tour as he works for Skoda, and you've driven around VIPs for Skoda throughout the whole Tour de France for...
Every stage for the last 12 years.
So there you go, 12 years, every stage for the past 12 years, which for someone that stopped and didn't want to look at a bike to get back into it in the biggest sort of bike race, and you do the Tour of Britain for the first commissaire car always, which I love because I get to have a chat with Tim and have a little hold on for a bit longer than normal. But no, going back into that and going into the Tour and working alongside that at the biggest, most stressful bike race, that must... did you love it at first or did you hate it? You must have not... There must have been some parts where you're like, this is ridiculous or not. Because doping was still going on massively 12 years ago.
Yeah, but But the doping was obviously going on because the first few tours, it was, I can't even remember who won because they got kicked off or whatever. So, but I did it. No, it was just good fun. It was good fun to do it. We had a good team. I got it was via Roger Hammond. Roger Hammond had been asked to find. It was quite a difficult criteria. You had to be first English language. You had to speak a few languages. You had to be an ex-pro bike rider. And obviously you had to have the whole of July to be able to go. So there wasn't really that many candidates. So I sort of managed to wheedle my way in there.
It's different now, though. So you go on the tour and you've got every chuffing... Basically, you've got a world tour team in the peloton. You had Andy Schleck.
Stephen Roach.
Andy Schleck, Stephen Roach, Staff Skier Links.
What's this called? We won the Paris-Roubaix.
Oh, what's Van Someren?
Oh, yeah,
and Van Someren as well. So it's mental you talk about cycling. Even those guys, they were like massive earners, you know. Van Someren won Roubaix, Frank Schleck. Was it Andy or Frank?
Andy.
So it's mental, really. You think, you look at that, you won all these massive adepts, won the Tour, won Paris Roubaix. Yeah. I don't know, I'm not being funny, but now they're battering around with you at the Tour de France, looking after bike racing. But for them, it's so recent. You'd surprise, like, for me... I've not fallen. I wouldn't. If I stopped, it's not because I didn't love the sport. It's just because I couldn't carry on trying to do all that training to be mediocre. You know, it's at the highest level that you want to do it. And if you have to drop down quite a few levels at the age I'm at, I wouldn't hate the sport, but I just find it too difficult mentally to do it now at that lower level. Yeah. So I think for them guys, having to stop for whatever reasons it were, but earning so much money throughout the career and then having to stop and go and do that, it's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it is really when you think about it. But I think, you say they earn a lot of money. There's not one person that does bike riding because of the money, really. Every single person started bike riding because they liked it. And some got better than others. Some people, their highest ambition will be to finish a club run. Other people, like who I work with, win the Tour de France. But every single person starts because they love bike riding and the money's really got nothing to do with it. So they want to still be involved in the... that's probably the best way to be involved in the Tour, like driving VIPs about because we're in every stage. Got our guests go in a helicopter. They stay in the nicest chateaus in France. So really the fact that they were champions doesn't take away that they love cycling as well and just want to still be involved.
Yeah, I guess so. There's coffee there. Sorry, we're just having a coffee break. Chap, try that purple thing. Cruel. It's like a final sweet, chap, full of sugar. We say finale sweet. It's like what you have in the final, like a really strong gel. Or when I was amateur, I used to get Pro Plus caffeine tablets and a few Haribos and just whack them in a bit. But because you didn't have, you did have gels then, but they weren't like massive.
First person to use gel.
Okay, here we go. Look, modern stuff.
I always think I was one of the first people ever used a gel. I had a friend who was a runner in Norwich and he'd found this new South African product called Lepin's gels. And so I'd started using them. And then I remember nobody in Europe had really seen them. When I was racing in Portugal, I used to supply the whole peloton with Lepin's gels, which I'd buy and take back to Portugal.
Captain of industry, look, another thing. That's it really, chap. We obviously have a lot of discussions over the phone, but there's not really a lot to talk about after that, really. I think it's just, for me, just thanks to Tim Harris for doing it, but also Tim's been a mentor to me and learnt a lot. So if you want to come to Belgium and you want to be a pro cyclist, there's no better person than Tim Harris to learn from, really.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Yeah, it was good fun. Yeah, cheers.
Thanks for coming.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast and all that we do. It's very much appreciated. And you can still get your 25% off all your Science in Sport sports nutrition products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. That was an interesting half hour or so of conversation, wasn't it, Lionel?
It was. What did you take from it? Because I took from it the kind of pragmatism required to make cycling, which is, until a certain point, it's a leisure pursuit, a hobby, something you do for fun, and then turning that into a career. And that starts before anyone signs a pro contract. I think riders are becoming professional, if not in name, in spirit, a lot younger, a lot earlier. And Tim Harris is there's not really much romanticism, is there, in some of that chat. It's quite, paints quite a different picture to the one that we see on TV, the kind of the gritty glamour, but the glamour nonetheless, the sense that it's a hard job, and making a living and staying in the sport is not necessarily easy, and it's not something that's for everyone.
Yeah, Tim Harris is sort of an antidote to the British system, which Adam was part of before he went off to Belgium and lived with Tim for a bit and learned the ropes of professional cycling. And you do sense both are kind of pragmatic in a way, both are perhaps not romantic in the way that some of us perceive professional cycling or cycle sport to be, but also quite different. Whereas British cycling, it was very much about numbers and science, sports science. Tim Harris is an antidote to that. He's very much about learning the craft, the profession of cycling, and I think that it's very rooted in Belgium, in Flanders, isn't it? That idea that cycling there is a serious business, with emphasis on business, and I think Tim is a great teacher in that. And it's interesting that Blythe, it was his last chance saloon in a way, going to Belgium and riding as an amateur there and trying to attract the interest of a professional team. And the British system didn't work for him, but that system did work for him, and Tim Harris was obviously crucial in that.
Yeah, and Tim is not a downbeat kind of person at all. He's always positive, always upbeat, always got a word of encouragement. It's that sense of giving people, young people, a sense of their own personal responsibility in a way. You're not obliged to try and make it as a professional cyclist, but if you're going to do it, then give it everything you've got. And I think there's some valuable life lessons for those who don't necessarily make it in the sport as well.
Tim's a great, he's a great people person and a great enthusiast, and he runs a chair business as well, as they mentioned, but he can seem enthusiastic about anything at all. He's one of these people, a bit of a Matt White type character. Remember Daniel talking about Matt White as being somebody who has a kind of Matt White cloud of stored files where you could ask Matt White a question about absolutely anything and he would have an answer, he would have an opinion. And Tim Harris is kind of cut from the same cloth. He's very similar and very entertaining in that way as well. Tim's full of opinions and knowledge and wisdom. Not learned from books necessarily, but learned from life. And
he's not on social media, which maybe there's something in that as well.
Lesson for all of us. You've been listening to an episode of the Cycling Podcast. My name is Richard Moore. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.